morning, everyone. This is Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to the program. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we're talking about soul food, the lives of enslaved cooks, and the African-Americans who worked in the kitchens of every U.S. president. We're speaking with authors, historians, cooks, and culinary aficionados, Kelly Dietz and Adrian Miller. Dietz is the author of Bound to the Fire, How Virginia's Enslaved Cooks Helped Invent American Cuisine, and Adrian Miller wrote Soul Food, the surprising story of an American cuisine one plate at a time, and The President's Kitchen Cabinet. We also have friend of the show, hip-hop artist Cullen Patrick Wade, co-creator of the Nine Pillars Cultural Hip-Hop Fest. He's going to preview the upcoming events starting here in Charlottesville, March 30th through April 4th. As a reminder, you can check out all our amazing podcasts with guests like these, which make the show amazing, on the station website, 947wpvc.org. And Nancy, now it's time to see, are you there on the line? Thank goodness you're there.
Let me see. I am here. Ellen, I'm here. And, well, we're all here, I guess, until April 9th when Mr. Bolton takes over. But until then.
Oh, gosh. I was hoping you weren't going to bring that up. I'd rather have Michael Bolton.
I didn't.
I would rather have Michael Bolton. I'd rather have Michael Bolton.
Ellen, why aren't you White House Communications Director or Chief of Staff? Yes, just knock on the man's door and tell him. He, you know what, though? Honestly, I'm sure Trump would prefer that. You know, I mean, he's all about the celebrity, and then that would leave one more person at Fox Network. So you'd be doing the country, or at least the Fox Network, a service. It's an excellent idea.
I mean, every single person, it feels like in the last, you know, five appointments have been a Fox News correspondent. It's not
That's
funny.
True.
I laugh. I get mad at like the cable news network when they laugh about this stuff because they're supposed to be telling us the news. They're supposed to be telling us our house is on fire, you know. But I think funny helps.
Yeah. Well,
could you agree?
Funny does help, and I applaud those who can still find the funny in it. Because I know every week is worse than the last. So there you have it. So that's why I guess I truly, you know, let's just plan that after April 9th, we just keep our eyes on the sky and know where the safe zones are
right in
our cities or something. Anyway, but today is really important.
Today
is really, as you know, I'm sure you were going to talk about it.
I was.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. We can both talk about it. The only event I wanted to talk about today, because we mention events on the show all the time, that's on everyone's mind is the March for Our Lives in D.C. and also 800 or so sister marches all around the world, everywhere from Mozambique to Ireland, Mumbai and Iceland, and also here in Charlottesville at the Pavilion from 2 to 4 today. We're going to be rallying to support the end to gun violence and legislation.
Yeah. I have to say, speaking of how introduced myself today. I have been missing these voices. I know they've been speckled on talk shows since last month, but they're obviously all en masse again in the network, and obviously in D.C. and all, as you said, around the world today. But I missed them. I missed all of them since, like, you know, everything sort of always rescinds until, you know, because he's always stirring up more stuff.
Right.
And it's just nice to see them all, and I know whatever coverage I get, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be amazing today.
Right. I love that the only speakers who are allowed to speak have to be 18 or under years of age.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
No kidding.
Yeah.
How cool is
Isn't
that?
Isn't that great? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we are cooking with gas here. Is that an old-fashioned expression? But we have amazing guests here with us. Our guests are authors, as I mentioned before, historians,
yep,
cooks, culinary experts. We have Kelly Dietz and Adrian Miller. Kelly Dietz is a historical archaeologist, and historian, and author of Bound to the Fire, How Virginia's Enslaved Cooks Help Invent American Cuisine. She's a research associate at the James River Institute for Archaeology and visiting assistant professor at Randolph College. We're going to talk about the rich and complex lives of enslaved plantation cooks, the myths, the realities, and their role in plantation culture. And joining the conversation as well is Adrian Miller. Miller is a food writer, culinary historian, author, and certified barbecue judge. We're going to talk about that. His first book, Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time, won the James Beard Foundation Book Award for Reference and Scholarship in 2014. His most recent book is The President's Kitchen Cabinet, The Story of African Americans Who Fed Our First Families from the Washingtons to the Obamas. Adrian worked in the White House himself as special assistant to President Bill Clinton. So welcome to the program, Kelly and Adrian.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So, Adrian, I wanted to start with you. What led you to writing these books on food history?
The short answer is unemployment. Basically, it was coming out of the Clinton White House, and the job market was really slow, and I was watching a lot of daytime television, and it got to the point where I said, I should read something. So I decided to go to the bookstore I was browsing, and I came across John Edgerton's book, Southern Food at Home on the Road in History. And early in that book, he wrote that the tribute to African-American achievement in cookery had yet to be written. So I thought that was interesting. I reached out to him by email because I was convinced that someone had written that book, because by the time I got to it, the book was about 10 years old. And he said no one had really done it. And so without any expertise except for eating a lot of soul food and cooking some, I decided to take the journey, and that led to the soul food book. And while I was researching the soul food book, I came across these African-Americans who have cooked for our presidents. Only a few stories, and I said, if I can just get together enough stories, I want that to be the next book.
And so why did soul food become the focus of your first book?
Well, at first, I didn't think I would have enough material to write about the cuisine, the culture, and the cooks involved with African-American heritage cooking in the United States. But based on my research, I had enough material to write five books. So I decided to focus on soul food because I thought that was the most recognizable aspect of the food culture. And that would be an easy way to kind of introduce the subject and then go on to other things.
How'd you go, I know you had that law background, but did that help you with your research? How'd you collect all the research you got?
The law degree definitely, in the training, definitely helped with the research, thinking critically, and it helped me with the writing as well. But to research the book, I read about 3,000 oral histories of formerly enslaved people, often reminiscing about their childhood. I read about 500 cookbooks, thousands of newspaper articles, interviewed a lot of people, and then because I care about my subject so much, I felt like I needed to eat my way through the country. So I went to 150 soul food restaurants in 35 cities in 15 states.
Oh. Do you have a standout meal that you remember?
The place that I keep thinking about is Bully's Soul Food in Jackson, Mississippi. It's the kind of place where there's a table right off the main dining room, and periodically someone comes out and strips fresh greens and peels sweet potatoes.
That's great.
You're getting fresh stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And so, Kelly,
I
wanted to ask.
What is the ultimate soul food meal in your estimation?
Oh, okay. Let me just go through it quickly. So the entrees would be fried chicken or catfish or chitlins, which are pig intestines for those, the uninitiated. And then the sides would be greens, mustard, turnip, collard, kale, or cabbage. So for those people who've discovered kale in the last 10 to 5 years, welcome to the party. We've been eating them for about 300. And then black-eyed peas, candied yams, which are sweet potatoes, mac and cheese, some kind of cornbread, a bottle of hot sauce, and then some kind of red drink, because I believe red Kool-Aid is the official soul food drink. And you have to understand that in soul food culture, red is a color and a flavor. And then for dessert, it could be peach cobbler, banana pudding, pound cake, or sweet potato pie.
Wow. So, Kelly, so a lot of those foods that you mentioned, Adrian, came from West Africa, I believe. So, and Kelly's research is about plantation cooks and the like. So how significant a role did those people play, and what was the value of those folks?
Enslaved cooks in Virginia on the plantations and throughout the South were really, really valuable. They were worth more. You can see that through the probates and through the tax records. They were worth more than everybody on the plantation except for maybe the butler occasionally. And they had a really important role in not only entertaining the guests that was part of Southern hospitality, but also providing sustenance for the people that were enslaving them and sometimes the entire plantation.
So were they bringing their foods over?
That gap did surprise me. Sorry, go ahead.
So Nancy and I have this issue. It's technological, right? It doesn't speak to our relationship, where it's hard to sometimes, this is the sausage making I'm talking about. Sometimes there's a little bit of a delay, so we apologize for that. So go ahead, Nance.
Oh, okay. Kelly, I was just going to ask, were enslaved cooks trained? How did they get their training?
Yes. There's, of course, the very famous ones that I think Adrian will probably speak to. The president's chefs like James Hemings, who was trained in France, or even Hercules, who worked under some folks in Philadelphia when he was the chef at the White House for Washington. But the majority of enslaved cooks that I talk about in my book were trained in the kitchens or in the field, or they knew how to cook already when they came over from West Africa. And then they were then trained a little bit by some of the folks in the house, whether it was a senior cook that was enslaved, or maybe in the earlier years there might have been an indentured servant that might have been from England, and that person then might have taught a little bit of skills or sort of the ways in which the white folks wanted to eat to the enslaved people. But very quickly, and I would say, pretty quickly by the 1700s, absolutely, you see a predominance of enslaved African and African American people cooking in the house, and the indentured servant, sort of white cook, became sort of passé.
What were those working conditions like? Because obviously they're still slaves. So what was it like?
Absolutely horrible. I'm a professor, and a lot of times when I teach classes on enslavement, I ask my students the first day of class, if you had to choose, the funny thing is I'll say, would you want to work in the house or the field? And most of the students would say, I wouldn't want to be a slave. And that's their first initial reaction. And of course, that's obvious. But there's this preconception that working in the house was somehow easier, that you were privileged if you got to work in the big house. And through my research, I've shown that you're actually on call 24 hours a day. And if you think about Southern hospitality, and if you think about the ways in which Southerners and Americans value food and welcoming guests, when you value food and you welcome guests, you provide them meals whenever they show up on your door. And so if it was 3:30 in the morning and, the Smiths came up to your plantation, the bells would be rung and you'd have to get up if you were the enslaved cook and fix something for those people to eat. So you worked constantly, and not to mention it was hot. A lot of enslaved folks died from burns. When you make things like bread and biscuits, you have to, in the older ovens, you had to stick your arm in the oven to see if it was hot enough, and you knew it was hot enough if your arm burned. And so if you think about having to do that day after day to make sure the biscuits were ready, that is, a long history of certain burns on your arms and getting burned by the fire and having to lift heavy pots. It was excruciating work.
And you're a chef or a cook yourself, is that correct?
Yeah, I was for 10 years before I decided to do all this stuff.
Okay, so when you study the recipes, what did you find about how they were cooking and what they were cooking?
Yeah, so I approached it from multiple perspectives. I'm an archaeologist, I'm a historian, and I'm also a former chef. And so when I looked at, for instance, the cookbooks from the period, the handwritten ones that were written by the mistress, or even the published ones like Mary Randolph, and I would find evidence of menus for different dinners and the mistress's letters, I looked at those things not just from a foodways perspective, trying to figure out what came when, but I looked at it from the perspective of a chef and a former cook. How long would it take to make a certain meal? How many steps would it take to make a certain dish? And through that, I found out that, a typical meal that you would have on a plantation, especially if guests were coming, would take you days to cook. And so these cooks were having to plan out meals sometimes a week ahead of time if they had to pickle things. I mean, it was a factory of food in these plantation kitchens.
So, Adrian, what was the soul food myths, or what can you tell us about soul food that in your deep research about it?
Yeah, so two of the big kind of criticisms of soul food is, one, that it needs a warning label, the idea that if you eat this food on a regular basis, it's going to kill you. And the second is that this is purely slave food, not worthy of celebration. And so I wanted to sort out fact and fiction from that. And, to the health critique, if you look at what nutritionists are telling us to eat these days, dark leafy greens, more sweet potatoes, fish, hibiscus, okra, those are some of the building blocks of soul food. And then to the idea that it's purely the master's leftovers and not worthy of celebration, you find that soul food is a very deeply textured, complex cuisine melding West Africa, Western Europe, and the Americas. And in some cases, there are dishes from upper crust England that make it into the soul food repertoire. So it's just a much more complicated story.
Is that why, why do you refer to soul food as immigrant cuisine?
Yes. So my argument is that soul food is really the food of the immigrants or migrants who left the rural South and settled in other parts of the United States. because they did what other immigrants do. When you get to the new place, you try to recreate home. And if you can get the same exact stuff that you had back home, you do that. But often you have to find substitutes. You're borrowing from your neighbors. And so soul food really is a limited menu from the expansive menu you find in the rural South. And a lot of that has to do with the seasonality of foods and what could make it out of the South and survive the train ride to other parts of the country. But once you start to get settled and prosper, you don't eat the day in and day out stuff all the time. You start eating more celebration food. And the celebration food moves from the periphery to the core of the diet. So the things we think about with soul food, fried chicken or even barbecue or some of the glorious desserts, that was special occasion food in the rural South. But outside the South, when people are prospering, it starts to become more commonplace.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So can you talk more about African Americans' view of soul food, the different views that people might take?
Yeah, so some embrace it fully and look at it as the food of their heritage and, you know, something to be proud of. Others are, you know, they think of it as ingesting white superiority. It's, you know, because it's the stuff that white people didn't want. And that's one narrative that's been powerful. Another powerful narrative is that it is actually African Americans overcoming, taking these despised foods and other things and then turning it into something delicious. So the narrative can cut a lot of different ways. But right now, we see kind of a movement towards more vegan. And that's probably the hottest trend in soul food right now. Mm-hmm. And so it's embracing the healthy aspects of soul food heritage while also saying, yeah, get away from the pork and all of these other things that have been foisted upon us by others.
And the fact that there is, you know, this black and white views or black and white views of soul food, how does this white privilege, naturally, how has that hampered just the acceptance of soul food? What's your view on that?
Well, for a long time, soul food was looked down upon because it was just the food of black people. So it's like, why would white people ever want to eat the things that black people eat? But when you pierce the veil and you look at what people are actually eating, it's more about place than race or class, because pretty much black and white people of the same socioeconomic class were eating the same foods, not together. So that's another myth that's been perpetuated. But what I find these days is a lot of people just don't know what soul food is if they're outside of the community. They may have heard of it, but they don't really know what it is. Now, that is changing because outside the South, Southern food is one of the hottest food trends currently. So people are starting to learn more about the cuisine. But there's still this question of like, well, where does soul food and Southern food end and begin? And so I spend a lot of time trying to explain that. And I don't know if I have the best answer. My typical answer is that just soul food tastes better than Southern food, but that's not satisfying, right?
I don't know. I heard you come from Colorado, and people give you grief for even talking about soul food. So,
yeah.
I know you have to deal with that.
Yeah, I immediately lose street cred when I tell people I'm from Denver. So I win them back by telling them that I have Southern parents. My mom's from Chattanooga, Tennessee, and my dad is from Helena, Arkansas. So this is the food that I grew up eating.
I get it. I mean, I just heard you reference that a few times, and I never thought about that, that, you know, that might come up for you.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the idea, Kelly, actually, about inventing American cuisine, how do you feel enslaved cooks have participated in inventing American cuisine?
Well, if you think about the South as sort of the birthplace of the colonies, you know, Virginia, 1607, you're going to have enslaved folks from West Africa coming in fairly early into the colony. 1619, you've got the first 20 coming into Jamestown. And, you know, pretty quickly they start being enslaved and they're being used to do all sorts of things. And one of the things that they were doing was cooking. And when the colony began to grow and, you know, ladies were coming over from Europe and these grand homes were being built all by enslaved laborers, you've got a certain sort of expectation of dining that also follows all these folks from England and from Europe. And at the center of all that are enslaved cooks. And so they were responsible for cooking the meals of these people that were hosting heads of states from all over the world and, you know, really sort of defining what it meant to have an elite meal in Virginia or the colonies generally.
This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. You're listening to Apropos of Something. We're talking with Kelly Dietz and Adrian Miller, authors of the book Bound to the Fire. That's Kelly's book. And Adrian's books are Soul Food and The President's Kitchen Cabinet. We'll be right back, and we'll hear more from them in just a moment. Stick with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something and 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with Adrian Miller and Kelly Dietz. Kelly, I wanted to ask you, this is the focus of your research, these topics that we've been talking about, enslaved cooks. Why is it important?
These are important because, you know, we all love food, and there's a, you know, a sort of amnesia in this country about the history of enslavement and the legacy of enslavement and what it meant to be an enslaved person and where we're at now and dealing with the legacy of all of that. You know, you think about centuries of slavery and 100 years of Jim Crow. We're not that far away from all of those legal sort of statuses of these folks. And, you know, there's also a sort of misunderstanding in the fact that we don't know a lot about them, and we don't know what they've, well, some of us know what they've contributed to our culture, but there's a sort of lack of, you know, credit and authorship that is given to enslaved folks for everything, whether it be building the University of Virginia or building the entire United States of America through their labor. And one of the things that they contributed was this sense of pride in cuisine and the food that we consider American now.
And in terms of this cuisine, how much, being that they are enslaved and all the conditions that they're up against, how difficult was it for them to create a meal with any creativity, for lack of a better word, sorry?
I mean, I think, you know, the food back then was a lot more simple than it is now, with exception of Jefferson's chefs and others that were sort of more obsessed with French cuisine. The basic meal on these plantations was, you know, oyster stew and breads and puddings and roasted meats and those sorts of things. But, you know, you think about what enslavers and masters wanted out of their laborers. They wanted a sense of sophistication. And so, you know, it was all at the expense of the skills and the labor of these enslaved cooks. And so they were given a lot of leeway in creating things. You see a change in the recipes. You see the incorporation of West African dishes like okra stew popping up in the 19th century, written down in these handwritten cookbooks. And I would argue that they were being cooked the entire time, but the white folks liked them so much that they recorded them in the cookbooks and then sort of, you know, sewed them into what is considered now American cuisine.
Can you talk a little bit about how slave owners behaved when other people may have come by? They didn't want, we were talking a little bit about this, how they may have wanted to have hid the fact that they had enslaved labor.
Right. So there's actually something really interesting because I'm an archaeologist and I work with the built landscape. So cultural landscapes are really important in trying to fill out the sort of hidden records of these enslaved people. So one of the things I do is I look at the ways in which during certain periods in American history, the Revolutionary War, when we as a nation were trying to figure out who we were going to be, and the topic of slavery and the morality and the immorality of it was on the forefront of a lot of these slave owners' minds. You see a pattern in the architecture. Things start to shift. Jefferson brings over dumb waiters. You know, furniture then can be placed in place of an enslaved person in a dining room. You see these hidden passageways being built that literally mask enslaved folks. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, if you were a guest, say, from France or somewhere where, you know, abolishment had already happened, you know you're going to go to Jefferson's house. You know he owns enslaved people. But there's a way in which you can mask that or keep enslaved people out of the space to, you know, not overhear the conversations about slavery being immoral or the fact that maybe one day they might become free or even revolts that were happening.
You know, I know there's, this may be like one question that that both of you may overlap on. I was curious, Kelly, anyway, what is the story behind Washington's enslaved cook Hercules that, anyway, what's the story behind him?
I love him to death. Do you want to take it or?
Start it off.
Okay. No, there's. Goodness. It's funny because, you know,
well,
Adrian's.
I'm glad you're going first on this.
Yeah, no, Adrian's got him on his cover, and I had a choice. I even paid the large fee out of my own pocket to have him on my cover if I wanted. But I ended up going with the nameless woman out of Amherst County because I felt like she was very representative of the people that I was talking about. But Hercules is an interesting guy, and I think out of, you know, James Hemings gets a lot of attention, especially in Charlottesville. But I would argue that Hercules, I consider him to be the first celebrity chef. He was brought from Mount Vernon. You know, George Washington bought him when he was 16 years old. He was brought up to to Pennsylvania, to Philadelphia, to be the first chef of the White House. I mean, he was there. And, you know, Pennsylvania at this time, 10 years before he got there, had the Gradual Emancipation Act, and Washington wasn't well aware of this. And there's these hilarious letters that he wrote back, sort of being a little panicked, because he found out that through this act, if you had enslaved people in the state of Pennsylvania, you had to free them within 6 months. So what he would do is every 5 months and change, he would take his enslaved folks, go back to Virginia, touch the soil, and come back up. Now, Philadelphia also had a vibrant free black community. And so you have somebody like Hercules, who, if you read, I think, both of our books, you see this amazing account of him. I mean, he wore silk stockings and velvet. He had a cocked hat, a gold chain, and a gold cane. I mean, this guy was something else. He would leave the kitchen, which he was known for running like, you know, Gordon Ramsay or one of these chefs that you think of now. He would leave and he would march down Market Street in Philadelphia. White men would bow to him. I mean, he had so much clout in this community. And then every 5 months and change, he had to go back and sort of reinstate his enslavement. And, you know, there's no surprise on Washington's birthday that he ran away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just to add to that, so one of the tripped out things about this is towards the end of his presidency, the second term, Washington suspects that Hercules is going to escape because he captures his son, or that he catches his son with a sum of money. And so to punish Hercules and his son, he doesn't send them back to the kitchen at Mount Vernon. He sends them to the fields to do hard labor. So Hercules escapes. We don't know where he went, ultimately, but there are some clues. There's a painting of him, what we're talking about, the image of him sitting in a museum in Spain. So he could have made it to Europe to sit for that painting. But he is cited in New York City after Washington's death. And the mayor of New York City at that time was a former secretary of Washington's. He writes to Martha Washington to ask if she wants him recaptured, but she never responds. But then he disappears to history for a lot of good reasons, because the risk of recapture was great.
So speaking of interesting personalities, you also write about Zephyr Wright. Can you talk about her?
Yeah, so many fascinating people in my book. She's one of my favorites. So she was the longtime cook for Lyndon Johnson. And she actually gets a lot of credit for his rise in Congress, because this is going to sound like science fiction, but once upon a time, members of Congress would have each other over for dinner, and they would get to know each other and be collegial. And so very few people passed up a chance to get some of her Southern delicacies. But she gets to sit in the family box when he gets inaugurated as president. I don't think any other cook has done that. And Johnson actually used her Jim Crow experiences of driving through the South to lobby for the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Because when the family would drive from Central Texas to D.C., Zephyr Wright would go along, but she could not go to the bathroom or eat with the family. So she got to the point where she stayed in D.C. year-round. And so when he lobbied for that bill, he used her stories. And then when he signed the bill, he used one of the pens and gave it to her and said, "You deserve this as much as anyone."
Wow.
Wow. Are there any, are there any other chefs from the kitchen that had a significant moment like that in history that obviously I have no idea about?
No, because there is such a code of silence that we don't get a lot of these stories. You hear more about kind of family connections and how these African-American cooks were often family confidants. But one noteworthy thing was that during the Roosevelt administration, for example, when civil rights leaders could not get the ear of President Franklin Roosevelt, they would actually go to the cooks and see if they could whisper something in his ear or talk to him about some civil rights issue. And Eisenhower had a guy named John Mooney, who was a valet, kind of helped with cooking every once in a while. And he was often consulted on civil rights things and was asked for his opinion. So you find more examples of that. But I think Zephyr Wright is the most poignant example.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the book President's Kitchen Cabinet by Adrian Miller. And I wanted to mention the website is adrianemiller.com, where you can read all about that. So what are some other stories about the president's cooks?
Oh, so one of my favorite, and I talked about this at the Virginia Book Festival, but I love this drinking story, which involves one of the African-American butlers, a guy named Alonzo Fields, who worked from the Hoover administration to the Eisenhowers. But the Trumans loved to have a cocktail in the White House, and so one of their favorite cocktails was an old-fashioned, which is bourbon, rye whiskey, simple syrup, some bitters, and some kind of citrus element. So the first time that the Trumans ask for a drink, the butler makes the drink, and Bess Truman doesn't say anything the first night, but then the next morning she asks, Fields, could you make these a little drier? We're not used to our old fashions being so sweet. So he reconfigures the formula, serves them the next time. Bess Truman doesn't say anything. The next morning she says, those were horrible. They tasted like fruit punch. So Fields is now a little hurt, slightly annoyed. So the next time he just gives them two splashes of straight bourbon and some ice. And Bess Truman takes one sip and looks at him and says, now that's how we like our old fashions.
You know, that reminds me of something Kelly was saying about what about the fear sometimes put into the slave owners.
Yes, this is one of the things that I actually really love talking about as a scholar of slavery. A lot of times, you know, what you read are just really painful stories, and you know, you just get overwhelmed by all of the sort of darkness of all of the stories that you hear and the abuse and everything else. But there's something that I think I found really fascinating with all of this is enslaved cooks had a little bit of what I call soft power. They were able to at least pose a threat to the white family that they could poison them. Because if you think about the importance of an enslaved cook or a cook generally, you know, they have the power to feed you and make you healthy, and they have the power to make you sick, and they have the power to kill you. And when moments like Nat Turner's Rebellion or any of the other slave revolts happen throughout the Atlantic, you see a sort of current that sort of slides through the women of the house, and they start writing letters to each other about being worried about being poisoned. And when you think about that threat and you think about the ways in which a lot of these enslaved cooks could sort of pose that and gain certain things of just, you know, treat me right and I'll treat you right. They had a power that other enslaved people did not have. They were able to, if they chose to, which was risky, absolutely. And a lot of folks did choose to poison their enslavers, and some of them got off and some of them didn't. But, you know, they had the choice of doing that. And that's something, that kind of trusted relationship, I think, set up a really unique social relationship between the owner and the enslaver and the enslaved.
Was that part of the reason that they did start, as Ellen asked earlier, that enslaved cooks started to be hidden away, you know, from view, to keep them away from hearing things that might be discussed at a dining room table, et cetera? Was that intent? Anyway, was that part of what happened?
I didn't see any evidence directly of that, but I assume that probably happened with some of them. I mean, there was just, you know, the idea of slavery was something that a lot of the people who enslaved these African Americans were constantly thinking about. You know, they knew it was wrong, and they were trying to think of any excuse possible to justify their way of living. And, you know, if you were born into this, if you were born anytime in the 18th or 19th century and your family had owned slaves forever, you know, you're going to have a harder time, you know, sort of letting go of that privilege.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about, Kelly, the Jim Crow laws and how that affected the enslaved people and their owners, and the difference between the two times.
Yeah, so something really fascinating happened during the Jim Crow period. And this is, you know, of course, when emancipation happened, you've got, you know, people, sort of white folks, the government, you know, putting in these laws throughout the South to try to control the movement and the abilities of black folks to be equal citizens because they are now free. What you see when you go to plantation museums, and one of the things I do is I do consulting for plantation museums, one of the most sort of well-known tales or myths that you see on these tours is they talk about the whistling walkway. These are all over the South, especially in Virginia. And you see these signs and you hear these stories about, you know, how enslaved cooks had to carry the food into the main house through this, you know, underground passageway and whistle the entire time they're walking to make sure they weren't eating the food as they walked in. Now, this could be perceived as a couple of things. One, it could be a warning that the enslaved cook is coming and you should probably not be talking about certain things. But moreover, it's a, you know, what I found in my research is these stories are folklore. You know, they were born out of the Jim Crow era. You have to think about the intimacy, and I don't necessarily mean sexual intimacy. I'm talking about just the fact that black women and men were sleeping by the foot of your bed if you were a plantation owner. They were delivering your babies. They were nursing your children. They were raising you, and they were cooking all of your food. So to have this absurd story And to have these laws of Jim Crow where you went from having a wet nurse who was an enslaved nanny to then not being able to drink out of the same drinking fountain. Jim Crow did something really bizarre to the ways in which we remember and choose to remember and forget elements of slavery. That's a very different way that we think about it now.
Mm-hmm. You know, I know we started earlier in the show asking about your research, but if you wouldn't mind, just more detail about how did you find the stuff that you found? Because it's obvious we're busy hiding it from ourselves. So I just wonder how difficult that really was, and where did you find it all?
Yeah, you know, doing early African American history is one of the most challenging things you can do. And I think that that's, you know, there are a couple reasons why I do it. One, it's incredibly fun. I like a challenge. I'll take one any day. But secondly, these stories are really important. And, you know, they take a lot of time to render. And I found evidence of all these different things through whether it's the built landscape, looking at the landscape and looking at buildings as a text. It's a really important way to understand the living conditions of these folks and the social relations between the blacks and the whites during this period. I also looked at archaeological records. I'm an archaeologist, so I found evidence of these enslaved cooks and people in the big house practicing hoodoo and conjuring their ancestors, something that I think is a sort of misunderstanding now. A lot of folks think that all these enslaved people were Christian, especially in the 19th century, and you see evidence of them practicing traditional West African ancestor worship all the way through the 19th century. And I also looked at things like cookbooks and letters from the white folks who enslaved them, you know, letters from the mistresses complaining about the food or being excited about a meal that was coming up. And I looked at material culture and folklore. And I mean, every single window that I could find to try to find some sort of information. And I spent years looking at things that, you know, produced nothing. And so this is a cumulative project of about 10 years on and off of research, finding the little bits of information to be able to tell these stories.
Thank you for that. You know, I get it. Well, I'm sure everybody did. I just get a sense of just how difficult it is to find out how life really was back then, and I really, that's amazing.
Yeah, can you know? I just call that real fast? It's also important to note, too, that enslaved folks were not allowed to read or write, so you don't have this sort of wealth of literature from their perspective. You've got, of course, slave narratives and things like that, but when you're trying to figure out what life was like, you have to look through, you know, be really creative. You have to look through the white people's pens and pencils to be able to see what's there and the archaeology to round it out.
So, Adrian, what are you hoping to achieve through your writing?
So I love kind of hidden histories or untold stories. So, you know, that's what I aim to accomplish with the Soul Food book. With the President's book, I wanted to show that this collection of African-American cooks provided a window on black life that our presidents probably would not have had otherwise. And a lot of our presidents chose not to open that window, but I think our country has been better for the ones who did. And we made some progress on civil rights. But it's just to show how these were amazing culinary artists, family confidants, and at times civil rights advocates.
And were there any presidents that were more involved with their kitchen staff than others?
Well, I would say Eisenhower was probably the president who loved to cook the most. So he would take over a lot of cooking duties. In fact, he installed a grill on the top of the White House. So imagine in the 50s, you're walking down Pennsylvania Avenue and you see smoke coming out of the White House, and that would be the president up there grilling.
That's cool. So I was going to ask, what for both of you, since these stories are hidden and we don't know anything about them, what do you think should be done? What would you like to see happen? What can be done?
Well, I think one of the things that's happening now is we're just seeing a lot more people, I think, turn their scholarship on these issues and try to seek these stories. So I hope that by digging deeper and sharing these stories, we will show that African-American history is American history, that they are not distinctive in some sense, but not separable, really. And I think that the value that African Americans have contributed to I think, is being more recognized and more celebrated.
Mm-hmm. Right. Just telling the stories in school and everywhere.
Yeah, it's really important. And, you know, people, most folks don't want to know about slavery. You know, it's a very horrible period of our history, and it's something that's very uncomfortable for most people. However, it's really important to understand these things. I gave a lecture last week, and one of the people that came to my lecture afterwards said, you know, that was really inflammatory. Can't we just forget this and move on? You know, can't we just heal already? And, you know, for me, it's, you know, you got to talk about this stuff to heal. You can't just forget it. No one's ever healed from amnesia. And so, you know, one of the things that I really want this work to do is to provide sort of a gateway drug, you know, into talking about issues of slavery, you know, dangle the carrot and the macaroni and cheese. And then all of a sudden they've got a lesson in history that they didn't actually want to sign up for. And I feel like the work that we do is a way to kind of, you know, grease the wheel and get conversations going that are a little outside of the normal context of slavery.
I love that. Dangle the carrot and the macaroni and cheese. We have to go to a break, but we will be right back. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos. We're talking with Kelly Dietz and Adrian Miller. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something, 94.7 WPVC. We air every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. I'm with Nancy Lawrence and our guests, Kelly Dietz and Adrian Miller. They're the authors of these incredible books. Kelly's book is Bound to the Fire, How Virginia's Enslaved Cooks Helped Invent American Cuisine. Adrian Miller has written Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time, and The President's Kitchen Cabinet. His website is adrianemiller.com. So we wanted to thank you so much for being here. I know some of you, one of you, Adrian's from out of town, from Colorado, here for the Book Fest. And Kelly, you have a book signing to go to.
Yes, I do.
So if anyone wants to meet Kelly in person, the Omni at 11 o'clock, or you're going to be there from 11 till who knows when.
11:30.
11:30. So thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to say, Adrian can talk about, we talked about the sweet potato for like a half hour, and we didn't have the luxury of doing that, but it was really fun. So I really recommend these books. So thanks again.
Cool.
Yeah, when that restaurant opens, I guess Ellen will be expecting that on the menu. That
the sweet potato something.
And red drink.
I mean, absolutely.
It has an interesting history. Like, it came from Virginia, right? We could get into it, but anyhow, but I'm saying goodbye and then not saying goodbye. This is a problem I have. Anyway. All right. They're laughing. It's a good sign. Nance.
I know. I'm looking at the clock, Ellen. I'm not sure if we should do a news of note, honestly.
Really?
Yeah, I think.
Oh, okay. Well, Cullen needs to get settled. So if we have short, can we make it short?
Yes. Yes.
Really?
It's sad and short. Yes,
okay. What is it?
Okay. All right. Republican candidate Arthur Jones, a Holocaust denier and former leader of the American Nazi Party, will be the GOP's nominee in Chicago's 3rd Congressional District, because he ran in Tuesday's primary unopposed. No Republican stepped in to oppose him. I mean, all you have to do is be 18 and have a pulse, and anyway, no one did. So Tuesday, despite making his views no secret, you know, his past, 20,339 Illinois Republicans in the preliminary totals cast their ballots for this guy as opposed to voting for no one. And on his website, you know, clearly on his campaign website, the Holocaust racket was right there in the front. And because they didn't run anyone in this heavily Democratic district and Jones qualifies, he is now their nominee. So what do you got, Ellen?
There we go.
Well, should talk with Cullen.
Yes. I can make it short. It's kind of funny. NASA has confirmed that after spending a year in space at the International Space Station, astronaut Scott Kelly's DNA no longer matches that of his identical twin, Mark Kelly. So because of that, because of being in space, his DNA changed, and that is the Kelly who is married to Gabby Giffords, turns out.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's wow. Just a coincidence. I mean, that's just an interesting fact, too, but I thought it was interesting that this guy's DNA completely changed. Anyway.
It is weird.
So with no further ado, we have Cullen Patrick Wade, a.k.a. Fellow Man. Cullen is a hip-hop artist and co-creator of the Nine Pillars Hip-Hop Cultural Festival. It's a week-long fest in Charlottesville here celebrating hip-hop culture in all its forms. It's the second year of the festival. So welcome, Cullen.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Hey, everybody.
Hey.
Oh, I just knocked into the table. This is going to be a good segment. Off to a great start.
It is a great start. So tell us what's different. This is
Did
the
you
second...
bring any recipes? No, I'm kidding. Go ahead, Ellen. I'm sorry.
So I was just going to say that what's different this year? What do you have in store for us?
Well, so we're coming back. Last year was a very big success in our eyes. You know, as a young festival, in year one, I think we accomplished everything that we set out to accomplish. There were a few things that could have been better along the way. We're trying to correct those this year, and we're trying to bring back all of the events that succeeded the most and try a few new things. Mainly what we're doing differently is I had a long talk actually with somebody who's been a guest on this show many times, Dr. A.D. Carson.
Mm-hmm.
Had a long talk with him about about what he, as both an academic and a hip hop artist and a hip hop scholar, wants to see in a local festival, and he basically said, "I want to see representation for all the groups that have been left out of the conversation and people that have been ignored." So last year, we tried to represent as many of the nine pillars as possible. The nine pillars, once again, being DJing, MCing, graffiti art, breakdancing, beatboxing, street knowledge, street fashion, street language, and street entrepreneurialism, trade, and business. So of those, last year, a few were focused on more than others, and a few got sort of shortchanged. So this year, we're trying our best to correct that. We have a fashion show on Tuesday, the 3rd of April at the Ix Art Park, focusing completely on hip-hop fashion and soul food, believe it or not, to tie in with your last
yes.
segment.
Nice.
Ms. Tiff's Catering is going to be providing plates for that event, and we have a go-go band providing music. So that's called Heart Soul Runway, because we got the runway, we got the heart, which is the go-go music, and we have the soul, courtesy of Ms. Tiff. We also have, continuing on this sort of tack of trying to represent groups that we perhaps shortchanged last year, we're doing, and I'm very excited about this, we have the first, as far as I know, I've asked everyone, every time I announce this, I've asked people to correct me if they know any different, but as far as I know, the first all-female hip-hop show in the city of Charlottesville.
Woo-hoo. Nice.
Ellen, are the phones lighting up with angry callers?
They're callers, and I thought you were going to say, am I performing? Well, I decided not to perform
that
this year.
That's awesome, Colin. I didn't mean to do that. I'm sorry.
No. It's good. We tried really hard to get Ellen on there.
Mm-hmm. I had other plans.
Yeah. She had a gig in D.C. that night. So,
seriously.
And when I say all female, that means five female performers. Also a female DJ, DJ Tova, and a female host, Ms. Destiny Wright. So we're handing it over to the ladies exclusively for that night, and it's going to be amazing. We have Bonnie Cash is performing. We have Katie Little Bird from Over the Mountain. We have a local high school student, Anaja Johnson, a.k.a. Legendary Goddess. We have Miss America, Tony Testimony's wife. And finally, of course, we have Juice, your sister station, WVAI 101 Jam's morning personality Juice Box. So
Nice. It's
a very diverse lineup, style-wise, age-wise, and it's going to be great.
Tell us about the April 4th A.D. Carson event, a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so A.D. Has agreed to help co-curate and moderate an oral history of Charlottesville rap music event. I've been just calling it, up until now when I've been doing promo, I've been calling it an oral history of Charlottesville hip hop, but we talked about it and it became very clear that in 2.5 hours we would not be able to do justice to the entirety of Charlottesville hip hop, so we're focusing on rap music, which is what a lot of people think when they hear the word hip hop anyway, but as you know, there are nine pillars.
Yes.
So AD and I put this event together. It's going to be at UVA in 107 Old Cabell Hall. And we are going to have a panel, TBA, of luminaries, important figures in the history of Charlottesville hip-hop. We're going to focus on elders, but we're also going to have a few youngins in there as well. We're putting out a call for everyone and anyone who has any archival materials, show flyers, audio, video, photographs, ticket stubs, press clippings, anything like that, to send them to me so we can make a multimedia presentation trying to capture this tapestry that is the history of Charlottesville rap music. And hopefully, this is going to be the basis of an archive for the UVA Library's special collections.
Wow.
Yeah. AD and I are really excited about this because to focus on the local and to really respect the local and, you know, understand the significance of things that happen at the local level is is very, very hip hop. It's one of the foundational ideas and ideals of hip hop culture. And you know, a lot of local scenes, a lot of your local cultures never really get archived in any systematic way, and so a lot of them never get the respect they deserve for laying foundations for what comes afterwards. So hopefully what will emerge from this is a multimedia document and also a robust archive for preserving our history here in Charlottesville.
Why do you think Charlottesville is such a perfect spot for this event?
Well, I think that race is a conversation that's been on everybody's mind over the last several years, really, but in particular over this past year since the summer. I think that Charlottesville is an incredible intersection of race and politics and art and the reconciling of these vital questions and dichotomies and contradictions that exist at the heart of American life. You know, this is Thomas Jefferson's home, but it's also Sally Hemings's home, and that's why our oral history event with AD is called Sally's Kids.
What is it? I have a question about hip hop in general. What do you think? What would you want people to know about hip hop that most people don't know? Or any misconceptions about hip hop?
Oh, goodness. I think y'all asked me this last time.
Really?
last year when I was on. Yeah. I think ultimately, this is dead air and this is what we don't want.
Oh,
yeah. Well, blame Ellen and her gotcha journalism.
I didn't want to.
My gotcha journalism.
Yeah.
We're not playing you off. No. I just thought, you know, I just, because I was sitting here thinking, you know, this is something to be taken seriously. And I just wondered if a lot of people don't really take it seriously or, you know, push it off as something.
Absolutely. Yeah. Here's what I want people to know about hip hop that is often left out of the conversation. Hip hop is rooted in the struggle of black liberation and black pain. Being a white person myself, taking a leadership role in this, I don't want that to be misconstrued as me trying to take it or trying to colonize it. As often as possible, I put black people at the center of every event we're doing. And I think that the mass media and popular culture does Herculean efforts to try to de-racialize and de-radicalize and de-politicize hip hop, but it's always been a radical and political culture and art form. So don't get it twisted. As much as we like to have fun, what we're doing is very, very serious.
Well, thank you so much for being here. We're just about out of time. The Hip Hop Festival will be starting the 30th, right? March 30th.
March 30th is the first event. Through April 8th is the block party. We're announcing the lineup for that either today or tomorrow, so you can start getting excited now.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here, Cullen.
On the second annual, that's awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Much.
There's going to be a third.
Much luck. I'll keep liking and going to your stuff on Facebook. So.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, Cullen.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Nance.
Yeah.
So we have a time for a little bit of a palate cleanser.
Okay.
What did you think of the show today? While I get my music ready.
Don't you want to call me when you're in the car and discuss it?
Yeah, we always do the after show. Let's keep that private. So right now, we've got the palate cleanser. I just want to sing along when I hear that. So my palate cleanser relates to food, and it's about a few of the food fests that are going on around this world. You could go to Euro Chocolate. It's an event that draws 1 million people over 10 days, and this is in Italy's Umbria region in Perugia. You could go to the Espelette Pepper Festival in France.
Italy doesn't have enough going on. They have to be awesome with the chocolate as well.
Oh, yeah, and then just one more, because we're going to run out of time. Yeah. I want you to say something. The Fire Flower and Fork Festival in Richmond, Virginia. I had no idea this was going on in November 1 to 4, and they're going to take a global view on food. So that looks really cool.
November 1 to Fork, you mean? No. Anyway.
Good one.
I'm going to hold mine until next week because I know we ran out of time. Go.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, everyone. Bye, Nance. Thanks for being here.
Yeah. Bye, Helen. Bye-bye.